Today, it's all downhill from here. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, world's latest post covering finance and proper news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Steve from Canstar. Hi, Steve, how are you going?
Yeah, terrific, Martin. Great to be here.
Well, thanks for coming back. Another new year. Same old problems, only more so, it looks like to me.
Groundhog Day, I think, Martin. I think we're seeing exactly where we left off at the end of 2020.
Yeah.
We're seeing rates falling for depositors, which is the problem. Interest rates falling for borrowers, of course, which isn't bad. And you know, I think these are the same phenomena that we were observing last year.
Yeah, it is more of the same old, same old. It's just that I get more and more worried about savers and many older people who rely on income from deposits. And that's a real big worry, I guess. But let's start more broadly, because you've just run some interesting survey data on households' financial footprint and to the degree to which some are still struggling.
Yeah, it did. 30% of people are saying they're more pessimistic about 2021 than they were about 2020. Now, 45% are saying they're okay about it, but 25% haven't decided. Now, it says that a lot of people are still feeling a fair bit of hurt, and I guess that's not surprising.
Well, there's a lot gone on, of course, with many people still less work in work than previously, more part-time jobs, and job seeker and jobs keeper, of course, coming to an end at the end of March. And certainly my surveys also indicate that there are a considerable number of people who are definitely really struggling, really, just to make finances come together. So the outlook is still a bit cloudy, despite what the Reserve Bank may be saying.
Yeah, look, unemployment's down, but it's still 6.6%. Now, anyone who's become unemployed, anyone who's had their income reduced, is going to be saying, look, I'm not feeling too happy about the year going forward. It's not surprising. Of course they are. But it's not just them. Anyone who's living off savings, well, they'd be saying, gee, I'm not so keen on this either. I think I'm going to run out of money. So there are plenty of people in this category, even if they're not out of work, there are plenty of people who will be saying, I don't know how I'll make ends meet. Now, the 45% are optimistic. Well, maybe they had their money in the share market. And at the end of the day, maybe they were saying, look, I've had an amazing run here, and I'm now a fair bit wealthier than I was at the start of 2020. So I'm feeling pretty good. So you can find explanations for both categories of people, and you can see why some are pretty happy about the future and some are feeling, I'm not too sure.
Well, I've started to use the term the K-shaped recovery, right? Because if you are one of those households in the group where you've been earning right the way through and your stocks have done really well and your house price may be now rising and your mortgage rate's dropping, you're going to feel pretty good. The trouble is that there's the other leg of the K where people are still struggling with high levels of unemployment, low levels of income, greater uncertainty. And the thing I see is that we've got a bit of a concentration of the good news on the upper leg of the K, as it were, and we're sort of forgetting about the 1 to 2 million in the lower leg of the K who seem to me to be doing it very tough.
Yeah, look, the headlines are always, look, the Dow Jones is going up, the ASX 200 is going up, house prices are going up, clearance rates are great. All of the headlines relate to that sort of news. It's the interesting stuff. It's the good news stuff as well. So it's not surprising that that's where the focus is. But at the same time, there are those 6.6% of people unemployed, and they're obviously struggling. There are still people on JobKeeper and reduced incomes, and there are still people on fixed interest who have a much lower income than they did a year ago. So they're all the people that are doing it tough, and they're a little bit less visible than, oh, wow, we've broken another record with the ASX 200.
And, that invisibility, I think, also covers off some older households who perhaps are, again, less vocal, less socially media aligned. And many of them are still finding it very tough because interest on deposits is down, as you were saying. Cost of living still rising very firmly. And so therefore, you know, another silent sector of the economy that's being hit. I think there's another interesting measuring point which I look at, which is the number of shops that are actually up for let. And I wander around different areas. And interestingly, if I look in some of the less well-off areas, the let signs are everywhere. If I look in some of the more affluent areas, it's a totally different story. So again, another indicator of this bifurcation.
Yeah, there is. And even in the well-off areas, you walk through some of the big shopping malls, and you know, some of those, the high fashion end, you think, wow, what do these people do all day? They're sitting around, there's no one in the store. They've folded that shelf of shirts 10 times today because the stores look pretty empty, to be honest. Now, I know there's been a bounce back in spending, in retail spending, and we needed that for the economy. But I'm not. I think it's pretty uneven again. I think, yeah, hopefully the restaurants and bars and entertainment venues are coming back strong, and I think they are reasonably. But some of those top-end stores, I'm not sure they're actually doing it that well.
No, well, I think that the retail Armageddon is still ahead of us rather than behind us, certainly from my SME surveys. Let's just move the conversation on forward, Steve, because, you know, we touched on interest rates, but it's just worth looking in more detail, right? Because I have never seen such low mortgage rates ever in my whole life, right? It's just remarkably low. And yet, of course, it's also having the same mirror effect on deposits, where effectively, you know, you don't get anything, really, if you hold money in most accounts now.
Look, we saw a 1.75% rate come out a couple of weeks back. Now, 1.75, Martin, I didn't think I'd ever be old enough to see a rate like that. So that's incredible. And that's sure it was for a special, and sure it's only around for a month, but who knows, it might be extended. And if you can jump in on it, 1.75 is just amazing. Canstar has over 120 loans with rates below 2%. So it just shows that that's not a one-off. And it's largely fixed rates, but we'll probably talk about that later. The deposit side, though, is terribly scary. The big banks are only paying 0.4 to 0.45, including the sign-on bonus, the introductory bonus, 0.4, 0.45 on savings. Now, that disappears after 3 or 4 months or 5 months, and you go to 0.05%. You can't live on that. You're living purely on capital. You're eroding the capital very fast, and sooner or later, you'll be on a pension. So, yes, we're seeing both sides, and it's extreme at both ends. Now, that's meant to happen, I guess, but I think it's a little bit more extreme because of quantitative easing and the impact that's having on deposit rates that bounce on. And the term funding facility, too. Wow. You know, and it's borrowers are raising money at 0.1% from the Reserve Bank. It's hard for depositors to compete with that.
Well, of course, the term funding facility from the Reserve Bank is flowing in very, very cheap funds into lenders, and they're happy to pass that on. The thing about chewing up your capital, of course, which is what ultimately people who with savings are having to do now, is that can go on for a period of time. But unless rates recover relatively soon, that's going to run out of runway before they probably get to the end of their physical runway, as it were. That crunch is ahead of us. And it's interesting that the Reserve Bank yesterday said they expect rates to stay low for, you know, 3 to 4 years. I think we've got to be thinking about how to cope with a zero interest rate environment for many years ahead.
Yeah, look, it's not going to recover. Whether it hits zero or goes below zero, I don't know, but it's near enough now not to make much difference. And the Reserve Bank is saying at best 3 years. So this could be 4 or 5 years. Who knows? And there aren't many places to go from here with for the Reserve Bank or anyone else. Certainly depositors. I mean, if we get to negative rates, and then I don't think we get to negative home loan rates, but we could well get to negative cash rate, negative bond rates, which does flow through to lower again home loan rates and almost zero savings rates. So, I think we'll have to say to ourselves, well, look, we've got to put money into different asset classes, mix it up, diversify it a bit, and hope for the best, to be honest. But, I mean, we'll all be taking more risk in an environment that probably is a pretty tough one.
Well, that's certainly higher risk. And I go back to the UK, right, because they took rates very, very low after the global financial crisis. You know, a decade plus later, they're still stuck there. They've got all the same issues we've got, only probably in spades because of the worst virus situation. So it's a real challenge in terms of trying to navigate all this. Now, one of the things you did mention, I think we should come back to, is this issue of fixed versus variable rates, because a lot of the rates that are the best rates are fixed rates. But are you seeing any variable rates also coming down into this same territory now?
Well, we are, but not 1.75. There is a 1.77% rate, but that's at an LVR of 70%. The regular LVR is 80%. So there's one of those. But there's a handful of rates that are below the 2% mark that are variable, but then there are sort of 100 and something that are fixed rates over varying terms. Yeah, so out to 4 years for some of them. They're they're the big two of the big banks, Westpac and CommBank, at 1.98% for 4 years. So that's where most of the action's been. And of course, with the Reserve Bank guaranteeing a 0.1% 3-year bond rate, of course, it's kept funding costs for longer term for the fixed terms right down. And on top of that, the 0.10% term funding facility, why would you not, as a bank, want to lock some of that in now? You know, it's a great opportunity. And the term funding facility will disappear in sometime around June or maybe even earlier. So, you know, banks are going to say, we'll put our foot on as much of that as we can get right now, and we might have to bump rates up a little bit, but there'll be a bit of adjustment maybe. But at the end of the day, we'll make nice margin on this at this moment and for the next 3 years.
Well, in a way, you could argue that the Reserve Bank is essentially propping up the profitability of the banks by providing with very, very low funding. And, of course, that's happening around the world. In the Eurozone, in fact, where rates are negative, banks are being paid by the central bank to lend. It's a remarkable situation.
It is an extraordinary time. And but, I mean, some countries, well, you mentioned the UK, but Japan as well. Now, they've had negative rates for a long time. Denmark actually has a negative rate home loan. I think it's Denmark. I think it is. And you look at that and you think, how does that work? When that time comes, I want to go interest only, Martin.
Well, it's interesting because their interest rate's negative, but there's a bunch of fees that they're now charging.
There are a bunch of fees.
Correct. So actually, you're still paying. But nevertheless, the concept is
still really low.
Absolutely right. And I guess
it's interesting. I mean, just on that before, so people don't get the wrong idea. They still will have a home loan repayment. Nobody's going to let you go interest only when rates are negative. So you'll still have a home loan repayment, but you'll be basically paying off more of the capital than you're actually pulling out of your wallet. So it's quite extraordinary. It's an interesting time. Funny place for anyone to be.
Yeah, no, that's right. So the repayments are still there. And of course, because a lot of people have much bigger mortgages now because prices are running away, what it means is that they're actually committing more to the capital repayments. I do remind people that you just can't look at the interest repayments. You've got to think about repaying the capital down the track in some way, even on interest only. You know, the capital still needs to be repaid. So worth that thought.
Yeah, and all you're doing is postponing it and making a bigger bill for later on. Yep. And interest only probably seemed a good idea when people were used to inflation and saying, look, my wages are going to go up, the price of my house will go up. But, of course, the last few years we've got all these people have taken interest only, not made any capital reductions, not had any significant pay increases, and the house prices haven't gone up. So it's dynamite down the track.
Absolutely. And of course, again, Lowe yesterday said, don't expect wages to rise anytime soon. You know, he's saying 3 to 4 years, we might start to see wage rises stir, but probably it's going to take a lot longer than that. So, we can't bake in the prospect of considerable income rises. Whereas in the early 2000s, one of the reasons why we got out of jail quite nicely, even before the GFC, was that incomes were rising a lot faster than the costs of the mortgage. So actually, it was quite a lot more comfortable then than now. So this is something else to bear in mind.
Yeah, inflation papers over all sorts of mistakes. Your house price goes up, your income goes up. For a business, even investment decisions that are bad for the business, they get away with it because the asset price has gone up and they can sell the asset off and say, "Oh, how clever are we?" So inflation papers over a lot of mistakes made in finance. And when you've got no inflation, it's suddenly you've got to make the right decisions.
Pretty scary for a lot of people, a lot of businesses. And interestingly, the other point is that there are still a lot of people, as we've discussed before, with mortgage rates that have a 3 or a 4 in front of them. The old apathy tax, as we've discussed previously, is still alive and well, isn't it?
Look, I looked the other day and there's still I think it was a 5.5% or 5.7 or something was the highest rate. I looked then and said, "Oh my gosh, I hope not too many people are there." And I'm sure there aren't too many people there. But the average rate is 3.3%. The big banks have their package rates of 3.3, 3.5, 3.6. Now, they're the rates that they were putting most people into for years. And there'll be a lot of people still on those rates. The difference between a 3.3%, that's the average rate, repayment, and the 3 point and a two 1.99% repayment is $3,300 a year. So, I mean, people have to do something about this. $3,300 a year is just, you can't burn that. You can't gift that to the bank. You've got to get it back into your pocket.
Absolutely. Well, you don't really want to be subsidizing the bank's profits, particularly in this environment. You want to make it easy for yourself. Now, talking about easy for yourself, there has been a significant rise in buy now, pay later facilities around the world, Australia, included. And a lot of people are using them, but there's an interesting report just come out from the UK, where effectively they are now recommending that buy now, pay later is seen as a credit product. That's a significant change.
It is. I mean, this has been debated in Australia, well, ever since it appeared, the product. But again, the Senate came out in September with the latest findings on it, and they've allowed a different set of rules for buy now, pay later, and basically none of the sorts of rules that apply to banks when they're lending you money or giving you a credit card. Banks have to say, well, look, can you afford to repay not just the debt on the card, but also the absolute limit on the card over 3 years? With buy now, pay later, which is the competing product, I guess, there's none of that requirement. Provided there's a warm party in front of you, and they can with a lot of buy now, pay later operators get the credit there and then. Now, I use the word credit because I see it as credit, really. You're walking out of the store with the new TV and you haven't paid for the whole of the TV. That sounds like credit to me. And the UK is saying, look, you'll have to comply. I think Australia will eventually have to come around to here because we've seen the debt trap in credit cards. I think we will see a similar debt trap in buy now, pay later. Now, it's not that either are bad products. They're both okay products, but they're not if they're not being used the right way. And unfortunately, some people don't know any better or can't control themselves. And whether it's plastic in the pocket helping you to spend on things you don't need, and you probably don't even want, and you certainly can't afford, if it's not plastic, then it can be buy now, pay later. They both can have the same cause and effect, and end up with people in the misery of that debt trap. So I think we've got to find a way of protecting people who are going to misuse it, and it's inevitable that people will, not through just through lack of real understanding of how finance works.
And of course, one of the tricks there with buy now, pay later is you only get slugged with heavy fees if you actually are late on your payments. But the trouble is that quite a few people now end up with multiple payment arrangements and suddenly find that they can't pay them all. And in fact, about 20% of people in Australia with buy now, pay later end up paying those fees. And they have a similar phenomenon in the UK. And interestingly, the UK report also made the point that there was a distribution of use where effectively more of those in the less well-off, lower socioeconomic groups, those who didn't really understand finance very well, were tending to use the facilities ever more. So again, it's not necessarily equally spread across all types of people. And sure, some know quite precisely what they're doing and use it really well. But the trouble is, we've got to think about those who perhaps are less able and willing to negotiate the hurdles And at the moment, I think it's just a bit too simple. And by the way, I'm seeing a big transference away from the use of credit card debt to buy now, pay later. And indeed, even payday loans is a little less because buy now, pay later is way more convenient.
Yeah, look, it looks low cost, but as you say, you start missing repayments. Those late fees are massive. And if you sort of push it all the way to the limit on late fees, you can end up paying, well, an effective interest rate of, look, I worked it out at some stage, but it's sort of around 40% or something. Now, it's not interest, they're fees, and they don't want you incurring that level of fee, but it's a big line number in their profit and loss statement. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is that, yes, people don't understand it and don't get credit, and they don't understand the mess they can get into. But the other thing that we have seen a fair bit of is that a lot of the buy now, pay later direct debit to repay it is actually going through to credit cards. So it sort of disguises the problem. It just pushes it from buy now, pay later problem to a credit card problem. And there's still $20.8 billion in credit cards that people are paying interest on in Australia. And that's a big number. It's come down a lot, but a bit of superannuation money into that. So you know, that's a one-off. And you know, I do see this causing the next generation. Our generation got into debt troubles with credit cards. And I think this the younger generation at the moment could very well find themselves in trouble with buy now, pay later. And that's why I think they have to get together, the industry has to get together with ASIC and say, look, we're sort of in agreement. We don't want to cause this problem. We want to find a solution to protect those who need protection. And it might end up a minority because I think the product's a good product. But we have to find a way of helping people to help themselves.
Yeah, and you have to recognise that the economy, as we touched on earlier on, is not, you know, necessarily looking rosy in all dimensions for everybody. And unfortunately, there could well be a bit of an attraction to use buy now, pay later to get through from one payday to the next payday, simply because it's you know, the best and simplest, most convenient option. Once you set it up, it's all online, so it's pretty simple and straightforward. Also make the point to Steve that payday lending is still there and it's still growing in some areas, and again, more through the online facilitation that's now very much part of the package, as it were. So I think the whole question of consumer credit and, you know, how it's actually sold and who gets it and what risks there are is something which we should be talking more about. And I'm a bit worried that, you know, okay, the responsible lending legislation is probably going to be removed at the end of March for mortgages. They are proposing some alternative protections for some of the low consumer credit lending and things, but they're still very light on, and I still think there's a very important discussion to be had about how we do protect those consumers who potentially can get into deep trouble if they're not careful.
Look, I think that's right. I think there are some there's a need to customise some of the protections. I don't disagree with some relaxation for home loans. I think people buy, you know, the sales process is a responsible sales process, and I think it will stay that way, to be honest, because people are, lenders are lending, you know, $400,000 on average. So I just don't see the wheels falling off there. But credit cards, buy now, pay later, payday loans, I think all need a stricter regime and more protections put in place. I think they're different for the different products, though. I think if you get too tough with your requirements on buy now, pay later, you kill the product off altogether because it's built around convenience and the instant approvals and stuff like that. But I think you can put enough in place that says, look, for people that are already in trouble, we will make this unattainable. At least protect that group, and then work out a way of protecting the group that's not currently in trouble, but you know, is likely to get there. And it's pretty easy with credit reporting to actually identify who's in trouble with credit right now and say, well, look, sorry, we're not going to give you more easy credit. Go to a bank and talk about your whole situation. Go and get counselling from one of the government groups and get back on track. Don't get deeper in.
Well, it touches on, I think, the point, which perhaps we can close out today on, is which is about education, financial education. I keep going on about this because for me it's one of the big issues I think we face in Australia, that there are so many people who really don't understand enough about the financial products that they have access to and use, you know, day in, day out, week in, week out. And I think it needs to start early. I'm a great believer in starting financial education, you know, during school years and beyond. Unfortunately, a lot of the stuff that is there is either myopic because it's pushed by the particular credit providers, or it's just way too complicated to be not helpful. So I do think there's a really big discussion to be had about financial education in Australia.
Yeah, there is. I mean, we've been talking about it for a long time, right around the country, and we haven't come across a solution. And because we haven't come across a solution, of course, the providers have jumped in, and that's been controversial in recent times. And we would prefer, of course, to see a situation where it's all brand agnostic. It sort of is right from the start, discouraging people from jumping into spending money they don't have. The first thing you don't want to upsell to a 20-year-old is a credit card. You want to explain to 12-year-olds, 15-year-olds that you spend what you can afford. In other words, what you can save, that's what you spend. So we've got to get those messages across, because they're not there's a simple message, really. You know, how much do you bring into the household, and that's how much that you can spend out of the household. Credit can tide you over if the car blows up or something, but not credit that will last for 4 or 5 years, credit that you can pay off after 3 or 4 pays. So there's some simple, simple messages that just I don't think have got through.
No. Well, I start from the very simple idea of, do you want to know what a cash flow is? You know, money coming in, money going out, you know. Yeah. It's a really, really good place to start. And in my surveys, less than half the households I survey have any idea about what money's coming in, what money's going out, right?
Yeah.
And there are
one of the proof points that I find really quite amusing is that quite wealthy people fall into this trap too. They talk about the wealth effect on spending, on household spending, and say, well, all right, because house prices are going up, because share prices are going up, now we can spend more money, and we do. People do spend more money. And you think, oh my gosh, you know, that's sort of like saying, I've got wealth in a house, which I will always have tied up, or even if I want to move houses, I'll probably still be tying up the same amount. I won't want to downgrade necessarily. I still shouldn't be spending more than I'm bringing in as income. Now, maybe I feel safe about a buffer now, but you know what? I'm going to live until I'm 80 something, and you know, running out early isn't a great idea.
No. Cash flow. You know, it's one of those. And I guess I've run a small business, so you know, I know all about cash flow in a business, yeah. And I know how dangerous it can get. And look, there are some good tools around. You know, the ASIC Smart Money website has some really, really good cash flow tools there. I often recommend them. But you know, there is an important journey of learning, I think, for many people. And you know, I think my advice is always, understand a bit more about the products that you're touching, not least because it means you can get better products, and if you understand the differentiation, you can negotiate better, but also understand some of the bear traps that are out there, because frankly, just because a bank can say you can have this size of the loan doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do.
It absolutely does not. I mean, it is in banks. Banks make money by lending people money. Now, they want to get repaid, so they won't want to push it too hard, but they won't necessarily say, or borrow less. They will if they can see you can't afford it. So they'll be responsible that way. But bigger and better isn't always better for you longer term. Sometimes you've got to be a bit more patient and say, look, I'll wait a little while. I'll buy this first property and then trade up, or I actually will drive around in an older car. But there is a lot of inducement to take on credit and get it all now. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously not always good. Our grandparents didn't behave that way, but we probably did.
Well, it's the old instant gratification, and of course, you know, have it today, and all the marketing messages and everything is all there. And I guess you could argue on one hand that you know, two rather older men complaining about the fact of the youngsters not understanding what they're doing is a bit light on. But it is important, right? Because you know, and I know, Steve, that many households do ultimately get into serious financial difficulty because the decisions that they take are taken on the wrong basis. And then, of course, it's not that you suddenly fall over the next week. This can grind on for weeks and months and years, and effectively can lead into broader relationship and social problems. So these are very, very deep issues, and I do think that better education can really help.
Yeah, look, I mean, we know that one of the biggest causes of marriage breakdown is money, and it does lead there. And the small debts that you start banking up now that seem insignificant actually do add up to a lot, and they add up to a big number that you can't actually repay. And you get to the point where you're working for the bank because you're paying interest rather than actually paying off debt and paying off the balance of the debt and getting freedom. You don't want to find yourself there, but a lot of people do. A lot of people find themselves just working for the bank, and all that interest out the door is too big a burden to actually pay off the loan in the end.
Yeah, and there is a bit of a theory that says, you end up effectively just going to work to be able to pay the bank, to be able to go to work to pay the bank. And if that is what life ends up being, I think we're missing something really important.
Yeah, and it's so difficult for people to put a full stop under that. because they've let it go for too long. It's all very well if you've got some assets that you can sell off and say, look, I'm going to downsize everything and start again, start fresh and work for myself and get back up on my feet. But a lot of people can't. A lot of people just don't have that escape route. And it's mistakes they've made in the past that could have been avoided if they'd known better. Unfortunately, it's hard to retrack it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's easy to fall into these traps. It's much, much harder to climb out, especially when, as we discussed earlier, there is little income growth and, employment prospects aren't necessarily always bright. And, debts tend to grow and become bigger and deeper. And effectively, it's a bit of a quagmire. So that's the problem. And quite often, in my experience, Steve, a lot of people don't really realise how deep the quagmire is until it's way, way too late in the piece.
Yeah, and look, really, at the outset, the problem isn't a financial services problem, it's not a financial product problem, it's a spending problem. And that's kind of where we've got to get back to. And our grandparents would have said to us when we were growing up, don't spend money you haven't already saved. Well, you know what? It's still good advice, and that's the real problem. It's a spending problem, and people just have to sort of get a plastic in the pocket. access to buy now, pay later is not your money. You're spending money you don't have, and you probably can't afford.
Absolutely, Steve. I appreciate your time today. I think that's really, really important advice, as always. And we'll put links to Canstar below. There's a great range of information there about different products and services. And we should have another chat down the track as all of these wonderful events to do with finance continue to evolve.
I think so. Definitely, Martin.
Thanks. Cheers.
Cheers, Martin.